this evening, metta for the disliked person. So that means that after all of this work and all of this time and all of this patience that you've had so far coming up to this point, we're about to take all of that and throw it into the dustbin and set fire to it. Because you're going to experience something that's going to make you very angry. Or maybe not. Hopefully not. But maybe it happens. And not infrequently. So meditation is this kind of funny thing where you kind of spend days, months, years building something up, and then you think you've got somewhere, and then all of a sudden it all falls apart. And if we do metta for a disliked person, and if we're not ready to do that, then you can find your mind gets torn up with hate as quickly as the Australian bush gets torn up with fire. So that's a bit of a bummer, but it's a learning opportunity, and we're all about the learning opportunities in Buddhism. So we're not going to let that be afraid of us. And like I said yesterday, you know, we do these guided meditations, and they are there as an opportunity to check out the terrain, to get a feel for exactly what's happening. But when we're really doing it and we're really doing the practice, we should be much more cautious and take our time. So remember to develop metta for oneself, especially for the first two stages, for oneself and for a loved person, and do that until metta is full and pure and beautiful and soaking through your whole body. And you keep it like that for 20 or 30 minutes, and you do that reliably on every meditation. And when you can do it like that, and the metta for yourself and for the loved person is the same, and you don't feel any difference, then you're ready to do the metta for a neutral person. And when you do metta for the neutral person and it still feels the same, then you're ready to do it for a disliked person. If you're not ready to do metta for a disliked person yet, then don't do it. But anyway, tonight we're going to break our rules and we're going to do it anyway. So the process is much the same as we've been through before. We have to choose a disliked person, and it doesn't have to be somebody who you loathe and detest. Okay, so it can be merely someone you dislike, somebody who you find annoying. Best to find somebody in your personal life who you find annoying, rather than a kind of abstract media figure like a politician or a sports commentator or something like that. And don't think about them, okay? Just think of them and then stop thinking of them, okay? Because otherwise you'll just keep on thinking about them and then that'll be it. We won't get anywhere, right? So just, okay, got that. Okay, stop. That's it. Right. So we should have in our mind, make sure you have in your mind always metta before you start to meditate. If you think that you're going to, or you might be going to do metta for these different stages, then make sure that you have someone in mind before you start to meditate. Otherwise, you'll get in the middle of the meditation and you'll be like, oh, that neutral person. Who was that neutral person again? Oh. But they're not neutral enough. And, yeah, so make sure it's someone beforehand. It's okay to admit that you don't like someone. Yeah, it's all right. We like to think that we love everybody, but it's all right. Yeah, it's all right. It's just being human. That's why we meditate. So it's okay to admit that there's some people we don't like. And when we come to that fourth person and we're doing metta for that fourth person, what tends to happen is that the meditation will change quite notably from when we do metta for the neutral person. The neutral person, the mind tends to be a bit disinterested and the energy tends to fall away. for the hated person, the mind is very interested. We are very interested in the people that we hate, and we want to, our mind wants to go to them. And so there's much, the energy tends to come back into the mind. The mind's very strong, and the mind tends to focus on it. And this is where you first start to realize really what we call about unification or one-pointedness or oneness of mind really means. Because it's like all of the other jobs that you have to do are done, and it's just this one thing, and you start to go into that. And the mind starts to get very bright and very strong and very powerful. And all of these distinctions, like I was talking about this morning, like these distinctions between the mind consciousness and sense consciousness, they start to drop away. The senses start to disappear. The sense of past and present and future starts to drop away. The sense of any change in your mind starts to drop away. It's very odd. So this is like, up until now, in this meditation, up until this point, The changes in your mind have mostly been things that are fairly gradual and fairly incremental. They're not really revolutionary. Like you feel, more positive emotions, you feel more peaceful and so on. But your mind hasn't really radically transformed or radically changed. So when you reach this point, if you've developed it fully up to that stage, then this is when your mind starts to really radically change. And these different parts of your mind start to drop off. And in your meditation, you might, for example, go for a period without thinking. Like your mind might be quiet for a little while, and then the thoughts might come back, and so on. And so that's kind of how the meditation is. But in this kind of meditation, it's almost like I'm not talking about any great level of samadhi. We're still developing the mind. But even at this point, it's like the thoughts don't have any room left in the mind. Yeah, you can still kind of think occasionally, and the mind can move occasionally, but the mind is like so full of this force of love and light that these thoughts and memories and distractions are just like these very small things on the periphery. And so the mind is very eager and leaps forward and wants to almost kind of devour and sink into this feeling of light and love, and you sort of go into that feeling. And yet at the same time, you can snap out of that so quickly, because your mind can drift off and start thinking about this person. And it's very, very tricky. It's very tricky, and you have to have really sharp mindfulness, because all of that power of your mind can equally be converted to be the power of hate. Love and hate is a duality. And that energy doesn't just go away. So if your mind slips into thinking about anger, and if those habitual patterns come up, then within a few seconds you can find that all of that metta and all of that brightness and all of that love is gone, and then the raging fury is there instead. Yeah? This can happen. Right? It probably will happen to you. Yeah? See how you go. And it can be very dramatic. Of course, it's not always so dramatic, right? But it can be. And so I'm just sort of priming you. I'm just readying you to say it's not just purely a gradual process where the anger gets less and less and less. Until our mind is really settled in samadhi, then there's always the possibility that it'll flare up again. So we keep the mind focused, we keep the mind going into that meditation, and we just keep that going as long as we can. At this point, we're still using the words, we're still saying, may that disliked one be happy, we're still pointing the mind to the meditation with the words, but the words are starting to kind of recede, they're starting to become less kind of important. And at a certain point, the mind will just leave them behind and we'll just go into the meditation. And you need less and less direction for the mind. So that there's the whole process of meditation where your mind at the beginning of meditation is more directed, and then as you go on it becomes more and more of a natural flow, and then eventually it just becomes completely just let it go and let it do what it wants to do. So that at a certain point as you're doing this, then there'll be a shift or a change in your mind. And at that point of that change in the mind is the arising of what my teacher refers to as the paritahaga nimitta, the what do you call the it's a somewhat obscure term, but the technical term in Pali is the counterpart sign. As I mentioned before, that the nimitta, the term nimitta is a term from later Buddhism, so this is a term from the Visuddhimagga, not a term from the suttas. But it is a real experience. It is something that happens. If nimitta appears, then the nimitta in metta is not necessarily a light per se, but the nimitta is the feeling of love. Right? But it's just perception. So it's actually light and love and all of those things and bliss and so on. And what you see or what you perceive is just how you perceive it. So if you want to say, can I perceive it as being a light? Yes, you can perceive it as being a light. Can you perceive it as love? Yes, you can perceive it as love. Can you perceive it as bliss? Yes, you can perceive it as bliss because it contains all of those things in there. But the essential characteristic of it is that it comes when the hindrances fade away and the mind kind of gloms on and doesn't go back, and the power of the mind just explodes, so that you feel like all this time that I've been meditating and I've been practicing, you know, I've felt calm and I've felt peace and I've felt energy and I've felt all of these things, and then you get to this point, you're like, all of that stuff is rubbish. Any peace that I thought was peace, no, that wasn't peaceful at all. You know, any bliss that I thought was blissful, that wasn't blissful at all. This is really blissful. This is really peaceful. This is really powerful. And the mind becomes bright and powerful like the sun. And it's not that you're struggling or trying to get by or trying to do this or trying to do that, but it's just this flow of consciousness and energy that just wants to be there, wants to say. So once this nimitta has arisen, the mind is quite solidly placed in the meditation, and your practice will flow on very easily. That experience is still not the experience of jhana, right? So that experience of the nimitta will last for a period of time, between a few minutes at the least, up to several hours. But that state of meditation, according to the commentarial tradition, is called neighborhood samadhi. And what it means is that you're just right there on the doorstep of jhanas. So you can just step into jhanas. Neighborhood isn't the best translation. Better translation is neighborhood, no, not access, no, but threshold. Actually, that's the best translation. The word upachara in Pali is a word that literally means the threshold of a building. So like that just outside that doorway, right, just outside that doorway would be considered to be the upachara for this room. Right, so that's what it means. So sometimes it's translated as neighborhood, but neighborhood is a little bit more distant, right? I mean, could walk down the road and round the corner, and that's kind of in the neighborhood of this building. And that's not really what it means. It means it's just there. And so at that point, jhana is just there. And you can go into jhana at any point. How do you do that? You can't, right? You go into jhana when the mind is fully prepared. But what happens is when the conditions are ready, what happens is that state of mind and that nimitta, which is so blissful and so peaceful and which you see in this so powerful of mind, within that, inside that experience, things just stop. And all of these things that you thought were peaceful and you thought this was so still, you realize there was actually all this movement in there. And then all of that just stops. You don't even realize that it was there until it's gone. And there's just this kind of letting go. And then the mind is just one. And then the mind's in this state of samadhi or state of jhana. And you can't force it. You can't program it. You can only do the practice that will create the conditions for it. In that state, and in that state of upachara, the last... and even before that, just coming up to the state of upachara, and in that state of upachara, the last defilements are the subtle sense of restlessness, the subtle sense of restlessness, and on the other hand, the subtle laziness or lack of energy, which will come in eventually. So when you get into that state The mind will ever so slightly be wanting to push. Yeah, you get this excitement for this experience. Ah, really? That sounds great. Oh, what's next? Yeah. And so this mind is very slightly pushing on it. But because in the mind, because of that point, everything is so amplified. Everything is amplified. The mind is so powerful. So even that very slight bit of tension and pushing, and then you can realize, oh, like I'm holding my belly really tight. And it's very strange because on the one hand you're so peaceful and so still, and on the other hand you can manifest these symptoms in your body of tension or something like that, even with a slight imbalance. Yeah? It's because of the power of the mind. And so the mind sort of wants to step into that and step up to that. And then after a while, then, of course, you know, like anything, it's conditioned. And after a while, the energy will fade away. And if you don't get into jhana, then the mind will eventually, the nimitta will eventually fade and you'll come back out of that experience. But if you just find that balance, yeah, very, very delicate. It's a very strange thing about meditation. It's like that the more peaceful the experience is, the more simple the experience is, then the more powerful it is. So all of we talk about the experience of bliss, right? And you have experience of bliss in that meditation. But the bliss and the rapture that you're feeling in that meditation are so subtle that you can hardly even sense that they exist. It's really weird, right? It's, on the one hand, it's incredibly strong. And on the other hand, it's very, very subtle. It's actually almost equanimity at that point. So even earlier in the meditation, you might feel stronger feelings of rapture and bliss, but they've faded away and now it's very, very, very subtle. So all of those things which have been happening in your mind, all of those qualities which you've been developing through this whole retreat and before the retreat, and the qualities of keeping your precepts and having that set of values of harmlessness and compassion, practicing with right speech, practicing with mindfulness, practicing with contentment, practicing with situational awareness, practicing with mindfulness of the body. All those hours that you've spent just sitting there patiently going over and over your basic meditation method. All those hours that you've spent patiently pacing back and forth on the meditation, walking meditation path, bringing your awareness back. All of that creates an energy and a condition, all of which comes to help and to support you at that time. So these things is an outcome of a long, long, long process. So maybe you will experience something like this in this retreat. Maybe you won't. Oh, well, too bad. Keep going. Yeah? The things that we're talking about are profound. The states of mind we're talking about are revolutionary and transformational. Enlightenment is the most profound thing that a human being can possibly do. And in a state of jhana or samadhi, the Buddha said is nibbana santike, is very close to nibbana. Yeah? Very close to nibbana. The Buddha even called it sambodhisukha, the bliss of awakening. Right? The experience of jhanas is described as the bliss of awakening. So it's very, very subtle. And to go into a state like that, you have to let go of all of everything that you've ever known. You let go of all your sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touches. You let go of everyone that you've ever known and everyone that you've loved. You let go of all of your memories, all of the things that make you who you are, all of your plans. You let go of your fashion sense. You let go of your house. You let go of your language. You let go of everything. And you step into a world which is completely unknown. And because that world is completely unknown, it's terrifying. And it's common to, when you're first practicing this, when you come into that, to reach a point where you feel like you feel like that there's this stopping and this feeling of being drawn into this state. And you get terrified. And your heart starts to beat. Dun, 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 dun. Oh, that's that. Everything's gone. Back to the beginning. Start again. Yeah? It's natural. It's normal. Of course you feel scared. It's weird, right? It's very, very weird. Everything is gone. And you're hyper-aware of everything. And mindfulness is so aware and so sharp. It feels like you've never been mindful before. And then you go into that state. And, you know, what is it like inside a jhana? Well, one friend of mine described it to me. He said it's like just being in a world of frozen bliss and light. So that's what the experience is like. When you're in there, the mind can't think or can't experience anything outside of itself. There's no hearing sounds or feeling things in the body. And the mind is just resting in that state of stillness and bliss and light and awareness. And it stays there for as long as it wants to. When it's finished, then when the conditions are ready, then the mind will withdraw. When you're very skilled at it, then you can make determinations about these things. So you can sort of determine before you go into the state, I'm going to go into that state for half an hour or something like that. That way you can do your jhanas and still get in time, get to your meetings on time. But when you're first doing it, then you don't have any control over that. So there's, you know, plenty of stories of meditators who get into different states of meditation and they just stay there for many hours, sometimes days even. So for most people, then these are things that take a long time to practice and a long time to realize. And I'm only... I want to share it with you and I want to talk about these things with you here on the retreat because all of you here are dedicated practitioners. Most of you are not practicing jhanas yet, but I have faith in you. And I think that if you keep on going and you keep practicing, that you can. I don't see any reason why not. As far as I can tell, everybody in this room is a human being. Okay, I stand corrected. Everyone is a human being now or will be soon. And everyone is capable of understanding these things and everyone's capable of practicing and everyone's capable of realizing these things. All of these things and all of these experiences, it's nothing. It literally is nothing. It's just when there are certain things in your mind that stop, that's all. Then you experience these things. That's all that's happening. And we don't realize that how much our minds are being driven by defilements, being driven by habits and hindrances and all of these things. That's what means that our minds are like the way that they are. And when those things stop, and the five hindrances stop. That's what happens. Samadhi happens. And that's a perfectly natural state of mind. If you've had even one hindrance in this retreat that you have let go of, one thought of anger that you've let go of, one doubt that you've let go of, one thought of desire that you've let go of, then you can get into jhanas. Because that's all it is. It's just letting go of those things. And if you can keep letting go of those things and let go of all of them, then you'll experience that state. And that state is the nekama sukha. It's the bliss of letting go. Well, sagdharamanankaritva labhati samadhin labhati citta sagek ekagatam. Based on letting go, one gains samadhi, one gains one-pointedness of mind. That's what these things are about. So if you don't realize it yet and you haven't got that far in your practice yet, just be patient. Just keep going. even in the beginning stages of the practice, even just doing a little bit, then we can already see the benefits of it. And this is one of the things that the modern mindfulness practices have shown us, and through things work like John Kabat-Zinn's and the MBSR, and then they've shown that even doing like a small amount of meditation, just 10 minutes of mindfulness practice, can already give you tangible and real benefits. And thousands of people have seen that. So you get those benefits just from a small bit of meditation that you do. But the thing about meditation is that the benefits don't get less as you go further on. They get more and more and more. And it exponentially increases. And if you get a little bit of benefit from a little bit of meditation, you'll get a lot of benefit from a lot of meditation. And if you can really mature and fulfill your meditation, you'll get abundant and countless benefits. So don't think of samadhi as being something which is like very distant and very far away on a hill over there. Samadhi is your heritage. And when you realize these things, this will be an experience which is unique, is transformational, is powerful, it will change who you are, and yet at the same time, it feels like coming home. It feels like the most natural thing in the world. It feels like, oh, I'm feeling normal at last. Because there's nothing normal about hindrances. I mean, so they're normal in the sense that they're part of nature, and statistically they're common, right? But they're not normal in the sense they're not normative, right? It's not like you have to be like that. It's just that most of us happen to be like that because of how we've been evolved and how our minds have developed. But if you let go of them, then wow, that's amazing. And in that period of time, you experience what the mind is like without hindrances. And even a powerful samadhi experience like that is still only a temporary experience. Inside the experience, the sense of time has stopped, and it feels like what the mystics call the eternal present. That's what the eternal present is. It's not, the eternal present isn't like when we think of being in the present. I used the simile a few days ago that being in the present is like riding on the back of a camel. Okay? And so you feel like I'm riding on the back of the camel, but I still could kind of fall off to the past or the future, right? You can fall off a camel easily enough, right? I've never ridden a camel, but I imagine you could probably fall off it easily enough. But that's not what the present is like in samadhi. Yeah? And this is what I was trying to convey in the talk this morning about the unification in time. There is no past and future. There's only the present. Mind can't wander off to the past and the future because it doesn't exist anymore. That's what that experience is like. And so this is that incredibly peaceful state of mind. And then you realize that past and future are just more complexities that we create in our mind. The past doesn't really exist. It's just our memory. The future doesn't really exist. It's just our plans and intentions. These are all constructs that have to be created with energy and effort in our mind. That's why it's stressful thinking about these things. And when we let those things go, it's so peaceful. And the mind is so still because there's literally nothing else. There's nowhere else. There's no when else. There's just this. And this is full of bliss and full of light. And that's what it feels like to finally come home. Let's do some meditation. sitting quietly. We let the mind settle back into the body. And gently scanning through the body to experience the different feelings and sensations in the different parts of the body. And then leaving the mind settled in the heart, say to oneself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. And repeating those words again and again and again. Evenly and steadily, with clarity and articulation, making a firm and steady, reliable grounding for the mind. And as you continue with those words, notice that along with the words is something else. Something more subtle. And that's the feeling of metta. Beautiful and soft, warm and joyful, full of love and light. Just keep your minds together with that feeling, holding the feeling very, very softly, like the little bird that the Buddha talked about last night. Just very, very softly. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. And letting that feeling of metta spread out and fill up your whole body. Soaking through every cell, every pore of your body, until the whole body feels like it's just one mass of radiance and love. to metta for the loved person, just bringing the name of that loved one into those words. May my father be happy. May my father be happy. May that loved one be happy. May they be happy. And keep on going, still keeping the mind grounded and centered inside your body, staying with those feelings of love and joy that come up. listening to the third person, the neutral person. Once again, keeping the name of that person in the words of metta. May that neutral one be happy. May that neutral one be happy. May that neutral person be happy. Letting the mind stay settled inside the body. Applying yourself with just a little bit more energy, a little bit more effort. Making sure that that feeling of joy and interest and enthusiasm stays there. to the disliked person, putting the name of that disliked person into the words of metta. May they be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Keeping the mindfulness very clear and alert, making sure the mind stays focused on that feeling of metta, right in the middle of the feeling, and make sure that you don't start thinking about that person, even the smallest, most innocuous memory or thought or intention about that person. Just their name and keeping the focus in the middle of that metta. May they be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Now coming near to the end of the meditation. From the disliked person, come back to the neutral person. May that neutral person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. May the loved one be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. To oneself, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away. Allow the mind to return to a neutral space, empty, open, and clear. Taking a minute to reflect back over the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. And ask yourself, what was that like? When we went to do the metta for the disliked person, what was that experience? How did that differ from doing the metta for the other people? Was the energy there to continue the practice? Was the feeling of metta still flowing? Did my mind edge at all into those feelings of hate or resentment? Or did it stay pure? And finally, we can dedicate the merits of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You can come out of meditation. Okay, so this evening, because we had an extra long guided meditation, I might skip the Dhamma talk for this evening. We've already had a fair bit of teaching for today, so that's quite a lot to digest. So I might leave it at that and then give you a bit of an extra chance to do some meditation this evening and tomorrow. And then we will pick it up tomorrow with the Faculty of Wisdom.